I'm joined once again by the authors of Waiting for Gonski, Chris Bonner.
Hello. Yes, indeed. Looking forward to this.
And Tom Greenwell.
Hi, Cameron.
And we're here today to talk about a recent report you have co-authored on behalf of the Australian Learning Lecture. But before we get into that report, let's just recap some of the background of how we got here. When we last spoke in March of 2022, you had recently published the book Waiting for Gonski, which was looking at the state of Australian education policy, nearly a decade after the implementation of the Gonski school funding reforms. And the general findings of your research and writing was that the situation was not great, that Australian school systems had become increasingly more segregated by socioeconomic status. I believe you said that the OECD data showed we had the fourth most segregated education system in the world, or at least in the OECD participating nations, and that our results were suffering from the huge inequity and funding disparity that our education systems were experiencing. About 2 months later, we had a federal election, we had a change of government. In that intervening almost year, what have you seen change in Australian education policy regarding schools and school funding?
What has changed is the rhetoric. Minister Clare has, consistently emphasised that he doesn't want Australia to be a country in which your educational achievement and opportunities is defined by your postcode. And, that's a very welcome statement of values. But as of yet, education at a Commonwealth level has been barely ranked as a second order issue. The main decision that Minister Clare has made, at least as far as funding, is to not make a decision, to defer the advent of the new funding quadrennium for a year. Of course, there's been reviews into initial teacher training. There almost always is, and the teacher shortage and other matters. But little tangible has changed.
Right, yes. And I mean, it is noticeable that Minister Clare has returned to talking about getting all schools to 100% of the school resourcing standard. But it's certainly not, as you mentioned, a second tier issue. It's certainly not his first talking point in any press release or media. It's always sort of buried towards the bottom somewhere.
Yes, and we'd argue too, Cameron, that even if we got there, as we'll enlarge on later on, I'm sure, even if we got there, it's not going to solve the problems that we highlighted that have continued since the Gonski review.
Mm. Well, let's look at your new report, which has been commissioned by the Australian Learning Lecture. First of all, let's just get some background to this report. How did it come about that you co-authored this report working with ALL?
Yes, look, I was contacted by Ellen Koshland, who I knew from many years ago, who was concerned about the same issues that we raised in Waiting for Gonski. The book resonated with her, and the book has had a reasonably high profile. But the book resonated with her, and she wanted us to enlarge in a shorter publication on what we were proposing as solutions to this escalating problem of segregated school enrolments and a negative impact on overall student achievement.
And so just to enlarge on that a little bit, Cameron, Ellen Koshland supports and is the founder of the Australian Learning Lecture, and its mission is really to sponsor and amplify big new ideas that can improve Australian education. So we were really, really excited that they wanted to support us in developing some of the positive proposals that we offered right at the end of Waiting for Gonski. It's been a really great process working with the Australian Learning Lecture. And the other thing that we should add is that, what's interesting here is that I think part of the reason why Ellen was so excited to see some of the arguments that we were putting in the book is that, she has been associated over decades with people like Jack Keating and others who, have for a long time criticised some of the unexamined assumptions of the way we set up education in Australia. So it's been a really great process.
So let's dive into some of the contents of the report. And I suppose, first of all, what is this report hoping to achieve? You said that you're putting forward in more detail some of the solutions from the end of your book. Who is this report for, and what are you hoping it will achieve in that audience?
So I think to answer that, it's worth emphasizing that we kind of told two stories in Waiting for Gonski. One was a story everyone's familiar with, and about how the funding hasn't arrived. But the other story was about how we argue that the Gonski report was lacking in certain respects in its very conception of what we need to do, because there was a contradiction at the heart of the Gonski report. It told us about how concentrating disadvantaged students together is very, very negative in terms of student achievement, but it effectively endorsed the drivers of segregation which are producing those concentrations, specifically unregulated fees in largely publicly funded non-government schools, unregulated enrolment practices, and taxpayer-fueled resource disparities, which would continue existing even if the full Gonski were to finally arrive one day. So what we're trying to do in this paper is to set out a positive vision about how we could address those drivers of segregation and, in effect, provide a more comprehensive solution to the problem that the Gonski Review identified. Our main objective with this paper is to speak to education policymakers, I would say particularly people on the public education side of the debate, to say, there's certain things that seem unthinkable in the way we talk about education in Australia, like the idea of, creating a common regulatory framework across the sectors, that aren't unthinkable if we look at a whole range of international examples. So our objective is to say to that audience, let's reconsider some of the assumptions that we've taken for granted.
Just to clarify and to make sure I understand this correctly, when you were talking about the drivers of segregation, and you mentioned that it was largely an absence of regulation and an absence of frameworks for operation for schools, it sounds like the segregation is almost a side effect of a sort of policy vacuum rather than being, well, is it the case that it's a deliberate choice and the way to get there is by absence of regulation, or is it a case of attempting to do other things that have just led to this as an unintended consequence?
You could argue, Cameron, that a lot of things have come together to make this happen. I mean, from the mid-1980s, enrolments in high SES and low SES schools have diverged even further, and also between the sectors, public and private sectors, they have diverged to the point where high SES schools, mainly private schools, at the top of the ladder, and other schools are enrolling a larger proportion of the strugglers. So that really has brought into sharp focus why it is that low achievers, in particular, when concentrated together, are not doing any better. In fact, they're doing worse. And high achievers, when concentrated together, actually aren't doing much better at all, if at all. So these things have come together, along with the research that's clearly pointing to the peer effects, the effects of other students on individual student achievement. Not only research, but the anecdotal reports from teachers and parents and school principals highlight this as a concern that has not been addressed. So we have to go to the framework of schools, in addition to reforms inside schools, before we can reach a solution.
And Cameron, just to add to Chris's comment, I think that the social segregation in Australian schools, the first step is to acknowledge that it doesn't just reflect geographical location, that that's a factor, of course, but our schools are much worse than locations, and it's affected by the drivers of segregation I mentioned. I think they exist because of a lack of regulation, and that lack of regulation is essentially a byproduct of us trying to do other things once upon a time. When state aid was reintroduced in the late 60s and early 70s, it was an attempt to provide choice or to ensure that those families who were choosing something outside the government system had access to a reasonably resourced education. And that was the objective. And some of the side effects of creating a dual system of publicly funded schools, one which is free and comprehensive, another which is fee-charging and selective, were acknowledged in something like the Carmel Report 50 years ago, but they weren't thought through fully and certainly not responded to comprehensively.
Well, as you said at the beginning of the interview, not a lot has changed policy-wise in the year since we have had a change of government, but you do have a section in the report outlining the kind of current state of schools as a result of this past couple of decades of policy. Where are we at the moment? What is the environment into which you are writing this report?
It's fairly diabolical. I mean, we're able to track what we're concerned about since 2010-11, because of the data behind the MySchool website. And it is really showing that high SES schools are accumulating more advantaged kids and are growing in size. Low SES schools are losing their achievers and are fairly static or in many cases shrinking in size. So to be able to measure these things over just a decade is very eye-opening. It's quite frightening. I never ceased to be surprised at the extent to which things have deteriorated. Well, certainly before Gonski, during Gonski, but of course even after Gonski. And we weren't expecting that. But that's what's happening.
And what's very clear in all the measures, whether it's PISA, whether it's NAPLAN, what have you, is the really massive gaps in students from different backgrounds persevere. So it's now, 3 or 4 years of learning which can separate students from the most and the least advantaged quarters of our society.
And can I just ask, how do you attribute cause and effect in that? Like, how do you say that the school segregation issue and the issues of inequity are responsible for this much of the decline in results or this much of the shift in results? How do you go about actually linking those two together?
I suppose it's because of the fact that the enrolment discriminators, whether it's by charging a fee or kids doing well in a particular test or whatever, or choices made by schools about who they enrol, they have continued unabated. Certainly, I mean, it's not about blaming parents for the choices and the decisions they make, but if you're a family and the school that you might be zoned for has a fairly substantial enrolment of strugglers, then it's hardly surprising that you're going to be looking somewhere else as a school for your child. And this has been the case since the mid-80s, but as I say, has accelerated.
And we cite a range of research in the paper, which, going back to the Gonski Review, which says that the impact on achievement of students' peers in their classroom or in their school is at least as substantial as the impact of their own family social background. Mm, yeah. So that, that evidence is coming from a number of sources, whether it's the Gonski Review or the Australian Council of Education Research or recently the Productivity Commission acknowledged the impact of compositional or peer effects. As for the kind of the causal, what's causing that link, I think the research is less decided, but there's certainly a number of links which are pointed to, which would be very easily recognisable for educators that, when you have a bunch of really advantaged, high-achieving students, they bring a whole lot of motivation, a whole lot of background knowledge to learning. They spur each other on to new heights. There's a, kind of constructive, competitive culture almost created around learning, and there's strong post-school aspirations and, you know, shared post-school aspirations. Whereas when you concentrate a lot of disadvantaged students together, it means there's huge demands on teacher time. There's often challenges engaging students and a lot of disruption. So learning time is reduced. And, you know, it can affect how schools and teachers target the curriculum. So often in very disadvantaged schools, the kind of academic subjects which are precursors to tertiary education are not on the curriculum. And it flows through into teacher morale and teacher retention and teacher recruitment. So, you know, Chris has done very powerful work on how the teacher shortage is a teacher shortage at some schools, but there's a teacher surplus at other schools. And the schools that where the teacher shortage hurts the hardest are you know, regional and remote schools often, and outer metropolitan schools, and geography plays a part there. But it's also harder to attract and retain teachers where the work of educating students is so much more challenging because of a huge concentration of social disadvantage.
Yeah, we've got to think of resources a bit more widely than we have been. You know, we talk about money as a resource and what money can buy, but school, I mean, I was a school principal in a former life. I know very well that students can be a very, very powerful resource for schools. And sadly, I'd have to say that when schools are pitched in competition with each other, as they tend to be in our system, schools go after those valuable resources. They look for those students, those enrolments that are going to enhance the profile in an image of the school, and its headline results. Which is really sad, because competition should be about improving the innate quality of schools, but it doesn't do that. It simply sends school principals and schools in search of the ones they want.
On that note, can I just ask, have you looked into these issues on a state-by-state basis? Like, there are obviously, you know, different state systems managed very differently, and I know here in New South Wales, where I am, there have been quite significant policy changes in the last few years on things like out-of-area enrolments for schools, trying to not, I suppose, to eliminate effectively a lot of out-of-area enrolment for students. And I'm just wondering, do you see a lot of policy variation between states, and is there much of a impact difference between states that do significantly different enrolment policies?
Yeah, can I just mention one thing that's really, really important? In New South Wales, we are the home of 48 selective schools. I think next in the Commonwealth comes Victoria with, what, 5, I think, from memory. That's a significant policy difference. And in that sense, on the basis of what we've been talking about, New South Wales, instead of being part of any solution, is part of the problem, because we are dividing within public education and across all sectors. We are accelerating that division of enrolments between schools that are advantaged and schools that are not. So there's those differences, and I'm very wary about comparing the states in such things as NAPLAN. I'm not quite sure how useful that is, but my impression is certainly in looking at the data I've looked at, which includes high school certificate and VCE achievement, we are not doing anything to help the situation at all in New South Wales.
Well, while we may not be comparing states within Australia, in the report you do compare the Australian system to a few other countries that are doing things a bit differently. Can we just have a bit of an overview of the countries that you choose to highlight in the report?
Yeah, so we talk about, you know, particularly Canada, where, of course, education is governed on a provincial basis. So think of Canada's largest province, Ontario. We see it as an example of something that Australia should be looking for inspiration, because in Ontario, the Catholic schools are fully publicly funded, they are free to the user, and they enrol on an inclusive basis. The way it actually works there is when you pay your taxes, you indicate whether your kind of those taxes are going to go to a Catholic school because you're a, or to a state-owned school, and that's where then your child will go. Now, the schools are funded on a needs basis, but you indicate that, and that also means that you have a right to your local Catholic school, if that's what you've indicated. So the first thing about a place like Ontario is it shows us about alternative arrangements where you can reconcile choice and equity. There is that choice between, you know, a religious ethos or a non-religious ethos, but it's done in a way in which schools are resourced on a common basis, both in the sense of money and in the sense of resources. Chris was talking about the distribution of students from different social backgrounds. And then what we see flowing on is that, you know, in a place like Ontario, not only have they outperformed Australia in PISA since its inception, but you also see in the OECD surveys of students in Ontario that they, disadvantaged students feel a much stronger connection with school, and they feel more positive about their prospects after school. So Canada is, and particularly provinces like Ontario and Alberta, is something we point to in the report. But also, I mean, what we emphasise is that Australia is something of an outlier in having schools which non-government sectors, which are so largely publicly funded with very few public obligations in return. So it's actually, you know, if you go to New Zealand or the Netherlands or Scotland, they all have fully publicly funded faith-based schools. And this is the norm. And so our argument here is, let's have a really hard think about why we've chosen to go on a different path, and is it serving us well?
And what about a bit closer to home? I notice you also compare the New Zealand system to Australia as well.
Right. And so New Zealand's interesting because it's very, very, it has a parallel history to Australia's, and the Catholic systems in both countries were on the verge of bankruptcy in the 1960s and 1970s. And in both cases, the states stepped in to essentially prop up the Catholic schools financially. But the kind of quid pro quo, if you like, in New Zealand was that New Zealand's Catholic schools would become what are called state integrated schools and would no longer charge fees other than a small maintenance fee to maintain the buildings that were owned by the Catholic Church. And those maintenance fees would be subject to regulation and would have to be justified. So they're very modest, even compared to Catholic schools in Australia. So it's a interesting example because I think it shows how, you know, a very similar country has a more rigorous approach to regulating non-government school fees. But it also, I think, we comment in the report that that loophole to continue charging fees to cover capital costs is a bit of a risk, and it means that over time it's meant that maybe the New Zealand model isn't as effective as say those provinces in Canada I was talking about, or a place like Scotland or a place like Netherlands, where faith-based schools are fully free.
Yeah, and the other thing about New Zealand too, it's interesting, New Zealand's a unitary state, whereas Australia's a federal system of government. And of course, in New Zealand, it was easier to secure agreement between the New Zealand government and the churches. In New South Wales, of course, we have this constant sort of bickering between the states. And even after the Gonski Review recommendations came out, there was Julia Gillard going from state to state to state to secure agreement, participation by the different states to what she was going to legislate, what she wanted to legislate. So that has beggared our school system ever since. I mean, even now, with the school's resourcing standard, the states are dragging their feet. And as has always been the case, going back decades, that is something we need to address head on. And in fact, Gonski came up with a recommendation of a way of doing that across levels of government, school authority, or resourcing authority, but hasn't happened, needs to happen if we're going to make any sort of progress.
So what do you see as the path for us to get here? Like, what's the roadmap this report lays out to get this conversation started?
Well, I think the starting point is our proposal, which is a common framework for all schools. And that is, as per the kind of international examples we've talked about, it would mean that we would have all schools that receive public would be fully publicly funded, and whether they're in the government or the non-government sector. And as a consequence, they would be free to the user and prohibited from charging fees. All schools that receive public funding would be open to children of all abilities and prohibited from excluding children on the basis of entrance tests and other similar discriminators. But non-government schools could continue to apply enrolment and other policies necessary to maintaining their special religious or educational ethos. And non-government schools that accepted these conditions would be fully publicly funded for recurrent and capital costs on the same basis as similar public schools and the same needs funding basis. Non-government schools that rejected those conditions would no longer receive any public funding at all. So I guess that's the proposal that we are suggesting as an ultimate destination. And we acknowledge in the report that there is a journey. Obviously, there's a journey to get there. And so what we really suggest in the report is that the first step is the unfinished business, and that is to fund all schools at 100% of the schooling resource standard. The second step, which could be simultaneous, is to create a new conversation about the common framework we're suggesting. We genuinely mean a conversation. We've offered a concrete proposal to provide some precision about what we think's at stake here, and to point out that the kind of arrangements we're proposing are very common internationally. But we need to there needs to be a lot of work to really think about what is would be acceptable to all the parties involved and what would work optimally in the Australian context. So we think a conversation needs to begin, and ultimately that could result in a national education summit, which brings all the major stakeholders together to hash out a deal and to agree on a common regulatory framework in return for full public funding of all schools. And we think that part of achieving the kind of arrangements we're arguing for is that we do need to revive a really good idea from the Gonski report, which is to establish school planning authorities in each state. And they, as we envision them, would be really responsible for ensuring that the kind of regulations that were agreed on were applied independently, neutrally, and transparently across all schools.
And sorry, what can we just dig into that a bit more? What would be the actual scope and authority of those individual authorities?
So they would be independent statutory authorities, and they would be, for instance, we talk in the proposal when you get into the nitty-gritty of how do you have common enrolment obligations, that there may be a requirement for reserved seating for disadvantaged students, for instance. Or there may be, in some other countries they have weighted lotteries to enter schools that are weighted against socioeconomic criteria. So it would be the responsibility of a school planning authority to oversee the conduct of those kind of mechanisms. It would be the responsibility of the school planning authority for zoning, because we're also arguing that zoning needs to extend beyond the public sector into the non-government sectors, so that part of being a free non-government school open to all comers would be that you would be people in your local area would have a right to a place in your school. So for instance, so the school planning authorities, the idea here is that, Australian Electoral Commission, we want it to be independent and arm's length from government and to be viewed by that. They're making controversial decisions or decisions which could be, contested, that they're viewed as independent and neutral.
Can I just ask, when you talk about things like weighted lotteries for enrolment that an authority might be responsible for overlooking, we've had a newly elected member of parliament here in New South Wales spruiking the idea of school vouchers once again. And school vouchers is a policy that often goes hand in hand with enrolment lotteries in some schools. Does your proposal leave room open for something like a school voucher system, or is that something that you would not want to see implemented?
It's always possible, but the point is about vouchers is that it is not accompanied by the regulation and the structural reforms that Tom was talking about. So vouchers wouldn't change anything. Vouchers were tried, for example, in Chile back in the 1990s. But they've walked away from that because they've walked towards greater regulation of private schools in their enrolment practices. You've got to solve all those other problems. Vouchers are no solution.
I'd frame it, and I agree with Chris. And I'd respond to the question by framing it a slightly different way. What we're arguing for is the extension of the universal provision of free education across all the sectors. But we're then trying to answer a question, which is, you could make sure all schools were free, but there's all sorts of potential for schools to become selective on a de facto basis, whether it's because of their existing location or their for whatever reasons, there's potential for them to discriminate on the students they enrol. And what we point to in the report is we have really concrete examples from places like Belgium or Paris or certain school districts in the United States where they've wrestled with how do we ensure that schools enroll inclusively, despite the fact that there is this natural tendency for a school to, create special programs to kind of encourage the high achievers and to maybe let the, tell the disadvantaged kids that, maybe their interests can be better served somewhere else. You need to regulate to stop that. And this is where these examples of things like, firstly, extending zoning to all schools. Secondly, having reserved seating for disadvantaged students may be a regulation, may be a requirement that you could impose on schools. Or having, as I say, weighted lotteries. We have concrete examples from internationally, which we can learn from.
Well, as you outlined before, your report does provide a fairly clear kind of 5-point plan for how to get from where we are now to this more regulated and equitable system. But what do you see as the particular considerations or particular obstacles? Like what is it preventing us from getting there that needs this conversation to happen? If you're able to point to the research and say school systems managed in this way achieve better outcomes for students, why do we need to have this conversation to get us moving in that direction? Why are we not already heading down that way voluntarily?
If I could kick it off, I think we need a very wide understanding in the community about what's happening now, how we got to this point and how bad it is. Because when there's a problem in our whole system of schools, we tend to resort to more within school reforms. So we need also to know why these within-school reforms, many of which are fantastic, why by themselves they haven't made the difference? Why are things still getting worse? So that wide understanding of the nature of the problem is really important. And the fact that we've got to look elsewhere, it's time we started looking beyond schools and beyond the usual raft of reforms for solutions. My feeling is that the Productivity Commission started going down that direction in its most recent report, but they also have a long way to go.
And then moving into, I guess, some of the political challenges, we argue that, you know, our paper is called Choice and Fairness. And we're really suggesting a common framework that we think will be better at providing both than what we currently do in Australia at the moment. Mm. But our argument is that part of the problem with the debate in Australia is that it's a debate where choice and fairness are pitted against each other as though there's a zero-sum game.
Right.
And so part of what we see as the challenge is that when, you know, you have an argument for Gonski and for needs-based funding and that involves taking some funding away from non-government schools, parents, schools across the non-government sector view this as an attack on choice. And we get into this debate about, well, do I, you know, I'm a taxpayer and, you know, this is the kind of education I want for my child and so on. And these kind of arguments come up. So what we're arguing is that a solution which provides both choice and fairness is likely to generate a larger coalition across the community, and that's going to be part of the road forward in dealing with the politics.
And remember, see, this is about starting a conversation. This is about injecting something different into the debates about schools. And so our challenge to anyone who might have their doubts is let's get the conversation going. And if they come up with something better, so be it. But of course, keeping in mind that it has to deal with that relationship between choice and equity. We can do both. And it also has to deal with the political realities. You have extreme suggestions on all sides in the previous debates. They're not viable unless we can get that broad coalition of interests together to work towards what we see as the priorities of having both choice and equity. What if we don't? I guess that's part of my response. What if we do nothing? And that's pretty frightening. On the basis of the current trajectory, if we do nothing, it's going to cost us big time.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, this conversation around education, I've been teaching myself now getting close to 20 years, and this has been the dominant political conversation between particularly the two major ideologies of our political landscape in Australia. And it always feels to me like it's one of those things, a bit like climate change, where the potential negative consequences are so far down the road, people have trouble seeing them in terms of what's happening right now. Yeah. And similarly have trouble seeing the state of where we are as the result of policy decisions made 20, 30 years ago.
Mm.
Yeah, this isn't coming. It's with us right now.
Mm.
I think that's absolutely correct, Cameron. And I guess just to add to Chris's comment that our argument here is, you know, we're proposing a constructive proposal here, and people can pick holes in it, and that's you know, we absolutely invite that conversation, but we would also challenge people who are engaging with the report to make an argument about how they think we should address the drivers of enrollment segregation, or do they think we should tacitly accept them? That's the conversation we have to have.
So just one final thing. You had the official launch of this policy just a little under a week ago from the time of this recording. Have you had much of a reception since then? Who has actually got their hands on the report, and have you had any feedback in the short time since it went to the public?
Yeah, there's been we were really pleased with the media coverage, and I think to me the most interesting piece of feedback or reaction was from the Victorian Education Catholic Education Commission, that, you know, said any proposal like this warrants serious consideration, which was just, you know, a response in the media, I grant, but it was also reflected an open mind. And I think that there is a risk that sometimes either side of the kind of school funding debates can assume that the other side is not open to conversation, not open to persuasion or, you know, rational dialogue. And I think that, you know, should make us think twice about that.
That sort of response, a fairly positive response, wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. So, and I think that's a measure of how things have deteriorated, and a measure of the wider range of people who are really concerned and are looking to a solution.
Well, Tom, Chris, thank you once again for what has been a fairly confronting conversation looking at the realities of where we are in Australian education and our policy landscape. Hopefully this does continue the conversation between the sectors and various governments of Australia. And I look forward to catching up with you again, hopefully to discuss some new policy initiatives that might arise out of this in the coming year or so. So, Tom, Chris, once again, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Cameron.
Thanks so much, Cameron.